In 2007, Dan Simmons unleashed a masterpiece that would redefine historical horror fiction. The Terror quickly became a cult phenomenon, eventually inspiring the acclaimed AMC television series and earning praise from Stephen King, who called it one of the best novels of its kind. The book brilliantly reimagines the doomed Franklin expedition of 1845 to 1848, where 129 men vanished while searching for the Northwest Passage. Simmons transforms this historical tragedy into a gripping supernatural thriller, blending meticulous research with a mythological monster that stalks the ice. The novel's claustrophobic atmosphere and psychological depth have made it a touchstone for fans of literary horror and historical fiction alike, exploring how the most terrifying monsters might be the ones we create ourselves when pushed to the edge of survival. The year is 1845, and Sir John Franklin leads two ships, HMS Terror and HMS Erebus, into the Arctic to discover the fabled Northwest Passage. Captain Francis Crozier, commander of Terror, serves as second in command despite his superior polar experience. The expedition departs England with great fanfare, provisioned for 3 years with the latest technology, including steam engines and central heating. What they don't know is that their primary food supply, thousands of canned goods, have been improperly sealed by a corrupt contractor named Goldner, setting the stage for slow poisoning and scurvy. By October 1847, both ships are hopelessly trapped in ice at 7005 north, 9823 west. Franklin has already died under mysterious circumstances, leaving the embittered Crozier in command. The ships have been immobile for over a year, and the men face a second consecutive winter in darkness. Worse still, something is stalking them on the ice. A massive creature that seems to combine the worst features of a polar bear with something far more ancient and malevolent. The novel unfolds through multiple perspectives as the expedition disintegrates. We witness the gradual breakdown of naval discipline, the onset of lead poisoning and scurvy, and increasingly desperate attempts to survive. When spring fails to bring the expected thaw in 1848, Crozier makes the fateful decision to abandon the ships and march south toward the Canadian mainland, a journey of over 800 miles across some of the most inhospitable terrain on Earth. What makes Simmons' narrative so compelling is his attention to historical detail combined with the slow-burning horror of the situation. The monster, which the native Inuit call the Tunbok, becomes both a literal threat and a metaphor for the expedition's doom. Yet the most terrifying aspects often come from the men themselves, as starvation and desperation drive them to mutiny, murder, and eventually cannibalism. The Tunbok represents Simmons' most brilliant creation, a supernatural predator woven seamlessly into Inuit mythology. Far more than a simple monster, it embodies the Arctic's rejection of these European interlopers. Described as an enormous white bear that sometimes walks upright, the creature possesses near-human intelligence and seems to deliberately torment the men before killing them. When it first attacks, taking Lieutenant Gore, the men believe it's merely an unusually large polar bear. But as the deaths continue, each more gruesome than the last, they realize they face something beyond their understanding. The Tunbok doesn't just kill, it mutilates its victims, sometimes leaving half-consumed bodies arranged in ritualistic displays that demoralize the survivors. Simmons masterfully employs the monster as both physical threat and psychological weapon. The creature seems to understand naval hierarchy, targeting officers first. It breaches the supposedly impregnable hulls of both ships, leaving claw marks in 10-inch oak beams. It lures men away from safety, isolating them before striking. Most terrifyingly, it seems to possess patience, sometimes disappearing for weeks before returning when the men have begun to hope it's gone. The Tunbok's relationship with Lady Silence, a mute Inuit woman whose tongue was removed as a child, forms one of the novel's central mysteries. The men initially suspect she controls the creature, but the truth proves far more complex. She represents a tradition of spirit governors who communicate with the Tunbach through ritual throat singing. Her presence aboard Terror creates tension among the crew, with some viewing her as their only hope for survival, while others see her as a witch responsible for their misfortunes. Through this supernatural element, Simmons explores themes of cultural arrogance and environmental hubris. The Franklin expedition carried all the technological advantages of Victorian Britain, yet found themselves utterly helpless against both natural forces and the ancient predator they unwittingly awakened. One of the novel's most haunting aspects is its meticulous portrayal of civilization's rapid dissolution when faced with extreme circumstances. The expedition begins with all the ceremonial grandeur of the British Royal Navy, gleaming brass buttons, perfectly pressed uniforms, daily watches marked by bells, and religious services conducted every Sunday with hymnal books carefully preserved from London's dampness. Within 2 years, these same men who once stood at attention for admirals' inspections find themselves transformed into desperate souls capable of unspeakable acts, their gold braid tarnished and their principles eroded by the merciless Arctic environment. Captain Francis Crozier serves as our primary window into this disintegration, his character arc embodying the expedition's broader decline. An experienced Arctic navigator from a humble Irish background, a fact that marked him as an outsider in the class-conscious Royal Navy, he begins the novel as a functioning alcoholic, nursing both his whiskey bottle and a broken heart after being rejected by Sophia Cracroft, Sir John Franklin's niece. As disaster mounts, Crozier demonstrates extraordinary strength by forcing himself into sobriety through sheer willpower, enduring horrific withdrawal symptoms that include hallucinations, tremors, and near madness, all while attempting to lead his remaining men through the growing crisis. The novel's psychological depth particularly shines in its portrayal of the officers' increasingly desperate attempts to maintain morale and the facade of civilization. They organize elaborate theatrical performances, including Shakespeare's Macbeth, an ironically prophetic choice. They celebrate holidays with carefully rationed extra portions of rum and preserved meat, maintain daily routines long after they've lost meaning, and even hold a disastrous carnival on the ice. This last event, complete with costumes sewn from blankets and curtains, masks made from paper and cloth, and music from salvaged instruments, represents their final attempt at normalcy before it ends in fire and death when the Tunbach attacks, a symbolic destruction of their last vestiges of civilization. As food supplies dwindle and scurvy takes hold, with its telling symptoms of bleeding gums, reopened old wounds, and mental deterioration, the expedition fractures along both hierarchical and moral lines. Cornelius Hickey, a caulker's mate with sociopathic tendencies, emerges as the primary human antagonist. His careful manipulation of his fellow sailors and calculated violence reveal a darkness that existed long before the ice closed in. He forms a faction that eventually mutinies, leading to some of the novel's most disturbing scenes of cannibalism, where human flesh is carved and stored with the same methodical precision once reserved for naval provisions. Simmons excels at showing how different men react to these impossible circumstances, creating a spectrum of human response to extreme adversity. Dr. Harry Goodseer maintains his humanity until the end, meticulously documenting their decline for posterity and refusing to abandon his medical ethics even when faced with starvation. Lieutenant Irving clings to his religious faith as a bulwark against despair. Magnus Manson, a simple-minded giant of a man, becomes a loyal puppet in Hickey's schemes. Most fall somewhere in between these extremes, ordinary men driven to extraordinary actions by the primal will to survive, their descent marked not by sudden breaks, but by small compromises that accumulate like layers of Arctic ice. Through Lady Silence and later interactions with other Inuit, Simmons introduces a profound counterpoint to the European worldview that drives the Franklin expedition. The Inuit have not merely survived, but thrived for countless generations in the harsh Arctic environment that is systematically destroying the British expedition. They possess sophisticated knowledge that the British officers and crew tragically dismiss as primitive. Knowledge accumulated through millennia of practical experience and passed down through oral tradition. This includes crucial survival skills such as constructing igloos that maintain temperatures above freezing even in the harshest conditions, tracking and hunting seals by identifying their breathing holes beneath the ice, and preventing scurvy through a carefully developed diet of raw meat, organ meats, and blubber rich in vital nutrients. Lady Silence's character arc serves as a masterful exploration of cross-cultural understanding. She transforms from an initially mysterious figure, viewed by the crew through a lens of superstition and prejudice, into a fully realized person whose actions are guided by a complex cultural framework and deep ecological wisdom. Her evolving relationships, particularly with Lieutenant Irving and later Captain Crozier, reveal both the possibilities and challenges of bridging vast cultural divides. These interactions become increasingly poignant as the expedition's situation grows dire, highlighting how cultural arrogance prevents many crew members from accepting help until it's too late. The novel presents the expedition's catastrophic failure as stemming from a fundamental hubris, the unshakable Victorian belief that European technological advancement and methodological approaches could triumph over any environment, regardless of local conditions or indigenous knowledge. This arrogance manifests in multiple ways: the rejection of Inuit hunting techniques in favor of dwindling canned provisions, the insistence on maintaining British naval protocols in an environment where they become lethal, and the initial dismissal of indigenous warnings about both natural and supernatural dangers. Crozier's transformation in the novel's final chapters carries profound symbolic weight. His journey from proud British naval captain to Taliriktug, living among the Inuit and adopting their ways, represents both a personal and cultural surrender that paradoxically becomes his salvation. This transformation suggests that true strength sometimes lies in the ability to abandon preconceptions and embrace radically different ways of understanding and inhabiting the world. The novel's themes resonate powerfully with contemporary issues, particularly regarding climate change and its impact on the Arctic. The Northwest Passage, which claimed so many lives in failed attempts to chart it, is now becoming increasingly navigable due to melting ice, a development that would have seemed miraculous to Franklin's men, but represents a profound environmental crisis. This ironic twist highlights how human ambition and technological progress continue to interact with the Arctic environment in complex and often destructive ways, even as traditional Inuit knowledge and ways of life face new threats from these same changes. Perhaps the most psychologically acute element of the terror is its exploration of extreme isolation. The men are cut off not just from civilization, but often from each other, trapped in darkness for months at a time during the Arctic winter. Simmons masterfully depicts the psychological toll this takes. Paranoia creeps in like the endless cold. Hallucinations become increasingly common, and reality itself seems to blur at the edges through prolonged sensory deprivation. The constant darkness, broken only by ethereal auroras and the pale glow of ships' lanterns, creates a claustrophobic atmosphere where time loses meaning. The novel's structure reinforces this isolation through its shifting perspectives, creating a kaleidoscopic view of deteriorating minds. We experience events through multiple viewpoints: Crozier's alcoholic depression and desperate attempts to maintain control, Dr. Goodseer's scientific rationalism gradually eroding in the face of inexplicable events, Hickey's calculating malevolence that feeds on others' fear. These fractured narratives mirror the men's fractured psyches, each perspective revealing new layers of psychological strain and breakdown. Dreams and visions play a crucial role, particularly for Captain Crozier, who experiences haunting premonitions of future rescue expeditions and the eventual discovery of the expedition's fate. These sequences blur the line between hallucination and supernatural insight, suggesting that extreme conditions might open doorways to perception normally closed to the rational mind. The visions become more vivid as the crew's isolation deepens. Some men report seeing loved ones walking across the ice, while others describe impossible creatures lurking in the endless night. The ships themselves become living characters, particularly Terror, which creaks and groans under ice pressure like a living thing in pain. Every snap of timber and groan of the hull takes on ominous significance. The men develop superstitious relationships with their vessels, seeing them simultaneously as prisons and as the only home they have left in the hostile wilderness. Some sailors speak to the ships, others claim to hear them whispering back, and the gradual destruction of these wooden sanctuaries parallels the crew's psychological deterioration. When they finally abandon the ships, it represents a psychological as well as physical threshold crossed, a final surrender to the vast emptiness surrounding them. Simmons draws extensively on historical accounts of Arctic hysteria and the psychological effects of scurvy, which can include depression, paranoia, and the literal reopening of old wounds, both physical and emotional. The men literally come apart at the seams as their bodies fail them, mirroring the social disintegration of the expedition itself. Vitamin C deficiency affects not just their bodies, but their minds, causing personality changes, night blindness, and terrifying hallucinations. The breakdown of social order follows the breakdown of individual psyches, as rank and civilization gradually give way to primitive survival instincts. The ships themselves become living characters, particularly Terror, which creaks and groans under ice pressure like a living thing in pain. Every snap of timber and groan of the hull takes on ominous significance. The men develop superstitious relationships with their vessels, seeing them simultaneously as prisons and as the only home they have left in the hostile wilderness. Some sailors speak to the ships, others claim to hear them whispering back, and the gradual destruction of these wooden sanctuaries parallels the crew's psychological deterioration. When they finally abandon the ships, it represents a psychological as well as physical threshold crossed, a final surrender to the vast emptiness surrounding them. Simmons draws extensively on historical accounts of Arctic hysteria and the psychological effects of scurvy, which can include depression, paranoia, and the literal reopening of old wounds, both physical and emotional. The men literally come apart at the seams as their bodies fail them, mirroring the social disintegration of the expedition itself. Vitamin C deficiency affects not just their bodies, but their minds, causing personality changes, night blindness, and terrifying hallucinations. The breakdown of social order follows the breakdown of individual psyches, as rank and civilization gradually give way to primitive survival instincts. As the situation deteriorates, the Terror becomes an exploration of impossible moral choices. How does one maintain humanity when survival itself requires increasingly inhuman actions? This question plays out differently for each character. Dr. Goodseer represents the moral center of the novel. Even when captured by Hickey's cannibalistic faction, he refuses to participate in butchering human bodies, maintaining his ethical principles to the end. His suicide, poisoning himself to make his flesh toxic to those who would eat him, represents a final act of both resistance and mercy. Crozier occupies a more ambiguous position. As commander, he bears responsibility for the lives of his men, forcing him into utilitarian calculations about who might survive and who must be sacrificed. His decision to abandon the weakest men at rescue camp haunts him, though it gives the stronger men their only chance at survival. Hickey embodies the complete abandonment of conventional morality. His faction initially justifies cannibalism as necessary for survival, but it quickly becomes clear that Hickey relishes the power his willingness to transgress gives him. He creates a twisted hierarchy based on cruelty and domination, with Magnus Manson as his enforcer and lover. Between these extremes lie most of the men, ordinary sailors and officers trying to reconcile their naval training and Christian morality with the brutal reality of their situation. Some, like Thomas Blanky, face death with dignity when they know they've become burdens. Others, like Goldner, who provided the spoiled canned goods, never appear directly in the novel, but bear responsibility for deaths they never witness. The novel refuses easy judgments about these choices. Even as we recoil from Hickey's atrocities, we understand the desperation that drives some men to follow him. Even as we admire Goodseer's principles, we recognize they lead to his death. Survival and moral purity prove largely incompatible in the world Simmons creates. While the historical elements of the terror are meticulously researched, the supernatural aspects allow Simmons to explore deeper themes about the collision of worldviews. The Toonbach isn't merely a monster, but a godlike being with its own complex relationship to the Inuit people, who have learned to coexist with it through ritual and sacrifice. This ancient relationship spans generations, built on careful observation, respect, and a deep understanding of the delicate balance between the physical and spiritual realms. In Inuit mythology, as portrayed in the novel, the Toonbach is a spirit cast down from heaven, neither animal nor god, but something in between, a creature of immense power that embodies both the terror and majesty of the Arctic itself. It formed a pact with certain shamans who gave up their ability to speak with humans in exchange for communicating with the creature. This sacrifice represents the ultimate price of spiritual knowledge, the inability to share it with others. Lady Silence, whose true name is Silna, is the last of these spirit governors, responsible for maintaining the ancient agreement through rituals passed down through her family line. The Franklin Expedition's intrusion represents more than just physical trespassing. It's a violation of spiritual boundaries that have existed for millennia. The Toonbach's attacks aren't random, but a response to this transgression, each one more purposeful and devastating than the last. When the men kill polar bears, which the creature sees as its kin, or desecrate the land with their steam engines, iron ships, and canned foods, they unknowingly provoke its wrath. Their very presence, with all its industrial trappings, disrupts the sacred relationship between the land, its spirits, and its people. This supernatural element allows Simmons to explore colonialism from a unique angle, transforming what could have been a straightforward historical narrative into a complex meditation on cultural arrogance. The British arrive with no understanding of or respect for indigenous spiritual beliefs, dismissing them as primitive superstition. Their inability to comprehend the Toonbach, to even see it clearly, as it seems to shift between forms like Arctic mist, symbolizes their broader failure to understand the Arctic environment. The creature appears differently to each man who encounters it, reflecting their individual fears and preconceptions about the unknown. The novel's climax, where Crozier undergoes a ritual transformation to become a spirit governor himself, represents a complete inversion of the colonial narrative. Rather than conquering the Arctic, he surrenders to it, giving up his tongue and former identity to join Lady Silence's people. This ending suggests that survival required not technological superiority, but cultural humility, a lesson learned far too late for most of the expedition. Through Crozier's transformation, Simmons suggests that true understanding of a foreign culture requires more than observation. It demands complete immersion and sacrifice of one's previous worldview. His journey from skeptic to believer, from outsider to guardian, embodies the novel's central theme about the cost of wisdom in an unforgiving land. The Terror has maintained its grip on readers' imaginations because it operates on multiple levels simultaneously. It succeeds as historical fiction, meticulously recreating the details of 19th-century naval life and Arctic exploration, from the precise terminology of sailing vessels to the social hierarchies that governed life aboard British naval ships. The authenticity extends to period-appropriate medical knowledge, the technology of early photography, and even the contents of the ship's libraries. It works as horror, with set pieces of supernatural dread that rival anything in the genre, from the nerve-shattering sounds of ice crushing against the hull to the terrifying encounters on the endless white landscape where shadows move against all logic. The novel's psychological depth is particularly notable in its examination of how different personalities respond to crisis. Through characters like the thoughtful Crozier, the aristocratic Franklin, and the increasingly unhinged Hickey, we see how extreme circumstances strip away social pretenses to reveal fundamental truths about human nature. The cramped quarters of the ships become pressure cookers where class tensions, personal ambitions, and primal fears simmer until they inevitably boil over. The novel's ambiguous elements continue to provoke discussion decades after publication. Did the Toonbock actually exist, or was it a hallucination born of lead poisoning and scurvy? The physical evidence, massive footprints, inexplicable damages, missing bodies, suggests something tangible, yet could be explained by more mundane causes. Was Crozier's transformation real, or a dying man's fantasy of escape? Simmons leaves room for multiple interpretations while making each possibility viscerally convincing, weaving historical facts with supernatural possibilities in ways that defy easy categorization. The book's resonance extends beyond literary merit into contemporary relevance. It touches on timeless themes, the limits of human endurance, the clash of cultures, the thin veneer of civilization, while also addressing issues that feel increasingly urgent: climate change, cultural arrogance, and the consequences of environmental exploitation. The destruction of the Franklin expedition serves as a cautionary tale about the dangers of technological hubris and the folly of attempting to impose human will upon implacable natural forces. Perhaps most powerfully, the terror reminds us that the most frightening monsters are often those we create ourselves. Whether through Goldner's corrupt food contracts that doomed men to slow poisoning, Franklin's rigid adherence to Admiralty orders that led them into the ice trap, or Hickey's embrace of predatory cannibalism, human decisions prove as deadly as any supernatural creature. The novel demonstrates how institutional corruption, from the Admiralty's political machinations to the cost-cutting measures in provisions, can have devastating consequences far from the corridors of power. In the end, what makes the terror truly terrifying is not the monster on the ice, but the recognition that, placed in similar circumstances, we too might be capable of either remarkable courage or unspeakable cruelty. The true terror lies not in the Arctic wilderness, but in the wilderness of the human heart when pushed beyond all civilized constraints. A wilderness that exists within every human being, waiting for extreme circumstances to reveal its presence.